Thank you very much again for coming along and answering people's questions.
No problem.
First question is from Stephen Harper, and he writes, getting started with astronomy, help required. He finds it it's an excellent show, fascinating and really informative. Thank you very much for that. Now, he's just bought a telescope, and he's started learning to enjoy the night sky with his two children. They are fascinated by the moon. How and what should I go on to show them next? Any advice gratefully received?
Well, this is a great question, of course, and the moon is superb through a telescope. And in fact, I've often talked to people about what are the best things to look at through a telescope when you first get one. And certainly, looking at the moon is a thing to do. I mean, it feels like you're flying above the surface of the moon. You sort of scan across you're flying above the craters. You can see incredible details of the mountains and the craters and so on. And actually, one of the good things if you're looking at the moon is to choose a time when the phase of the moon is such that it's not like a completely full moon. You might think that full moon would be when the surface pointing towards us is fully lit would be the best time to look at it. But in fact, you're better off looking at one of the phases where maybe you've got a sort of half moon or something, and then to look down what we call the terminator, which is the point which is where the moon goes from being lit to being in shadow. It's that sort of boundary line between the dark part of the moon and the lit part of the moon. Because you see shadows, the light's sort of coming from the side, and you get a really good 3D effect. When it's illuminated from the front, and so the whole surface of the moon is lit, the full moon, then you lose a lot of the depth information that you otherwise get. So certainly next time, make sure you do look at the moon when in that sort of phase, sort of half moon, or the waxing or waning phase. In terms of what to go on and show them next, then I would say that with a telescope or binoculars, Jupiter is the classic. I mean, look at the planet Jupiter, find the planet Jupiter, download one of these packages that we've talked about a number of times before, like Stellarium or CarduCL or something that will tell you where and when to look for Jupiter. But looking at Jupiter through a small telescope or even a pair of binoculars, you should be able to see first of all, the moons of Jupiter. So four of the biggest moons of Jupiter, the so-called Galilean satellites. So these will look like points of light, like stars, effectively, on sort of usually spread in a sort of line, more or less, horizontally across a sort of, well, an angle across Jupiter. Maybe one on one side, three on the other. Maybe two on one side, two on the other. Maybe one of them will be missing because it's either behind or in front of Jupiter, and you won't notice it. They're called the Galilean satellites because Galileo saw them. And interestingly enough, it's the International Year of Astronomy next year. It's 400 years since Galileo first pointed a telescope at Jupiter and saw those moons. So, if nothing else, during the year 2009, look at Jupiter's moons and think of Galileo. The other thing, on Jupiter itself, look for the cloud bands. You should be able to see through a telescope, you should be able to see these bands of different colours running across. Through a small telescope, they probably look sort of darker brown, lighter brown, whitish coloured. These are these cloud bands that you see in the gorgeous sort of Hubble Space Telescope pictures of Jupiter. You can see them through a small telescope. Lovely to be able to see that. Even the Great Red Spot can be seen. This is this big rotating storm in the atmosphere of Jupiter. That can be seen through a small telescope. Saturn's rings. Again, an amazing sight. I've shown many people Saturn through a small telescope, and they're always completely gobsmacked, if you understand that turn of phrase, when they look at Saturn, and you can see that it really does have rings. It really does have these little ears that sit out, sticking out either side of it. I would say that there's other things that you should look at in the sky that you maybe don't need a telescope for, actually. So you have a checklist of what to see. We've had the moon, we've had Jupiter and its moons, we've had Saturn and its rings. I would say get somewhere dark, dark sky, away from street lights. Look for the Milky Way. So try and see the Milky Way sort of arching across the sky. A gorgeous, gorgeous sight. If you're in the southern hemisphere, then obviously the Magellanic Clouds are another amazing thing. These nearby dwarf irregular galaxies close to our own Milky Way galaxy. Meteor showers, shooting stars. Everyone should try and spot a shooting star. If you go and look at a time of year when there's actually a meteor shower going on, then you've got a better chance of seeing a shooting star. That's basically when the Earth passes through the tail of a comet, or what's left over from the tail of a comet, big lump of dust orbiting the sun. And as the Earth passes through, we get many little bits of dust that burn up in the atmosphere and cause these shooting stars to whiz across. So look out for a shooting star, but you will see them, you know, any clear night. If you spend a bit of time outside looking up at the sky, you'll probably spot the occasional one, even if it's not a meteor shower, period. And then finally, the Andromeda Galaxy, I would say. You can see it through a telescope. It's much easier to find through a telescope, but in fact, probably the exciting thing to try to do is to spot it with the unaided eye, without a telescope or binoculars. And that's simply a matter of, you need to get a star map. You need to get a star map, like from Stellarium or something. Find where it is. Usually the trick is to work from the square of Pegasus and out through the constellation Andromeda, to turn right and there you've got Andromeda. So you need to sort of star hop, jump from one star to the next to find the Andromeda Galaxy. You can see it with the unaided eye. It's not spectacular. It's a very faint, little hazy patch of light. You have to know exactly where to look. You often have to, it has to be a very dark sky. You have to sometimes use a little bit of what we call averted vision, which is you look just to the side of the galaxy, and that opens up, starts to use a bit of the eye that's a bit more sensitive to very faint light. But you can see that little fuzzy patch, and the amazing thing about seeing that is that you know you're seeing a different galaxy. That's actually the farthest you can see with your unaided eye, generally. It's about 2 million light years away. So not only are you looking 2 million light years out into space, you're looking 2 million years into the past. So it's, you know, it's an amazing thing to think about doing, and I would encourage you to do that. So, yeah, get out there with your kids and show them these things. I'm sure they'll be amazed by it all. I should just say that I apologise for my rather croaky voice at the moment. I'm talking about having kids and so on. I suspect I've picked something up from my daughter, who's gone back to school recently and met all the other kids who've obviously carrying all these bugs, or it's possibly our undergraduate students, since they've all recently arrived back at university. So I'm a bit ropey at the moment, sorry.
So thank you, Stephen, for your question. Next question is from Daniel, and still with the moon. He says that he just got his first views of the moon, and he was so surprised. He thanks us too for the monthly night sky segment of the Jodcast, and he just noted that when he was looking at the moon, he found himself partially blinded due to the radiance of the moon. So he was curious to know if there is a safe time or way to view the moon through a telescope or any other kind of optics, presumably, so that you don't get dazzled.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's right, actually. The moon is spectacularly bright through a telescope. And, of course, you know, when you think about it, that's the point of a telescope. Most telescopes have got a bigger aperture, so the you would look at the diameter of this sort of end of the telescope, if you like. So it's the diameter of the lens or the mirror that your telescope uses. And that's can be quite large. I mean, some of the larger sort of small telescopes are something like maybe 25 centimetres in diameter. It's quite a large telescope that you might have at home. Well, if you compare that to your eye, even when it's dilated, when the pupil is dilated at its largest, it's probably, what, 5 millimetres across or something, maybe a little bigger. You know, that's 5 millimetres compared to 25 centimetres. That's a factor 50. So in terms of area, which matters, because that's what the light's being collected over, that's the square of 50, so that's what, 2,500. Mm. So you're actually getting 2,500 times more light in than you would in through your pupils, so it certainly appears very bright. I think, I mean, you're not going to be blinded by it, unless you're, you know, the sort of size of telescope we're talking about here. But it's certainly an issue. You would, you know, your eyes, if you're out at night, your eyes have got used to the dark, then your pupils opened right up. As you approach an eyepiece, actually, I would carefully approach an eyepiece that was the weather telescope that was looking at the moon, you'll see the brightness sort of radiating out of it. And actually what that'll do is it'll close down your pupil. And actually you'll find that a bit easier to look at the moon then. An alternative is, if you don't want to ruin your dark adaptation, is you can get little moon filters that sort of screw into the eyepiece of your telescope.
Are they just neutral density filters?
Yeah, so they just block the light right across the spectrum, so they're just sort of chopping out some proportion of the light, and just to make the moon look fainter. And it means that you can sort of look at the moon, and then you can still look back up at the sky and see the stars. Otherwise, if you look at the moon through a telescope, you look back up, everything's black and like Daniel says, you know, you can even get the sort of, you know, patches, you know, the sort of after images on your eye from looking at something bright. So yeah, it's not not something to particularly worry about. I would say, again, just a little pointer, of course, if you were looking at the moon around the time of a solar eclipse, then it wouldn't be a problem, right?
Yes.
Because, of course, the sun is very close by in the sky. Just don't look at the moon when it's that close to the sun. It's not a good idea. Never, ever go anywhere near the sun with a telescope or binoculars, or indeed your unaided eye.
Very good. Thank you for that. Now to another Daniel Scott Jordan. And he writes, he would like to know the names of any simple reference books that will help him recognize constellations. And he also asks if there are any filters, special filters that you can get that will cut out the light pollution when observing from within a city.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll tell you what we do. I think the easiest thing to do is to just put a few examples. There are, you know, there's lots, of mm-hmm. course. There's lots of books that will at various different levels will give you an idea of what you can look out for in the sky. So I think there's some that are updated every year. There's some that, you know, are good reference books that are always, you know, long-standing things. I think what the best thing for us to do is to put a few suggested ones on our webpage. So that sounds like a good idea.
For me to do this for some time, actually, is to put a list of books that we use for just basic night sky observing, and the one which I used to learn the night sky was Will Tyrion and Ian Redpath, Stars and Planets. It's an excellent book. The maps are easy to read, and there's lots of useful information in there as well. So that's just one. And as you mentioned, there's lots of others. So we'll put a list of those on our website.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that they're the only ones we'd recommend either, because of course there are many more. But we'll just stick a few on there just for pointers. Regarding this business about filters, he's actually talking about. This is a problem that you know, particularly to do with light pollution, where, you know, if you live in a city or in a town and, you know, the sky can be quite bright as a result of the street lights. And is there any way of blocking that? Well, there is, as you might imagine. There are filters that don't do a perfect job. And in fact, it would be far better if the lights just weren't there, of course. But there are filters that you can get that sort of screw into the eyepiece, for example, of your telescope, and they would try and block patches of the spectrum, bits of the spectrum where those streetlights are likely to produce much of the pollution. For example, some of the older style streetlights use sodium lamps, so there's a sort of gaseous sodium inside the street lamps, and they radiate very specific bits of the spectrum largely, and so one could design a filter that just blocks that bit of the spectrum and does a bit of a better job of making this background sky a bit darker. They do, you know, they can be pricey, however. So again, we might just stick some information on about that, along with the moon filter we just mentioned as well.
And our final question for this edition of Ask an Astronomer comes from Frank Sørensen, and he notes that the hype surrounding the LHC accidentally annihilating the world by creating a microscopic black hole seems to have evaporated, since we're all still here, presumably. However, he has been thinking about an argument regarding what would happen if you did have a very small black hole, which could pass through the entire planet without swallowing anything more than a few atomic nuclei, since the vast constituent of ordinary matter is actually empty space. And so Frank wonders what would happen if a cosmic ray particle collided with the upper layer of a neutron star and created a small black hole. On a neutron star, there's no empty space for the black hole to hide in, since it is one big atomic nucleus. So the question is, why doesn't microscopic black holes created by cosmic rays swallow the neutron stars?
Okay, well, complicated question. But in fact, you know, it's got, well, there's a couple of interesting things to pick up. I mean, this thing, the LHC is the Large Hadron Collider that we talked about, I think, possibly the last edition of the Ask an Astronomer section. This is the big particle collider that was switched on recently at CERN in Europe. There was this fear that it was going to create black holes that might swallow up the Earth. It was a bit of a scare story, as we actually discussed last time. And of course, you know, as Frank points out, we are still all here, presumably anyway. And so it didn't happen. Of course, one of the interesting things is it didn't happen because, apart from anything else, they didn't actually collide any beams together when they were switching it on, so it was never going to happen until they do that. And now the LHC is a bit broken as well, so it's not going to, there's going to be a bit of a delay in all this again. However, the basic answer to this whole question, you can pick up on some real details, if you want them, by looking at a big safety report that was written by a number of scientists from CERN and elsewhere, looking at the safety of the collisions that are happening in the Large Hadron Collider to sort of try and answer these sorts of questions. And I think maybe this whole issue about whether a black hole would be produced and why aren't neutron stars swallowed up by these black holes then, since cosmic rays will be crashing into neutron stars all the time, presumably producing these black holes, and therefore, you know, why aren't they swallowed up? Well, here's quoting from the LHC safety report. One might wonder what would happen if a stable microscopic black hole could be produced at the LHC. However, we reiterate that this would require a violation of some of the basic principles of quantum mechanics, a cornerstone of the laws of nature, in order for the black hole decay rate to be much less than the production rate, or indeed general relativity, in order to suppress Hawking radiation, which would cause the black hole to evaporate. So basically what they're saying is, if one could speculate that maybe it produces microscopic black holes, however, that would require a breakdown of all the laws of physics that we think we understand at the moment. So we actually don't think they will produce black holes. Well, let's say they might. There's lots of other information in the safety report about various issues, but let me just pick up on the issue that Frank refers to, which is the issue of the black holes that might therefore be being produced when cosmic rays hit dense stars. So it says, in fact, ultra-high energy cosmic rays hitting dense stars, such as white dwarfs and neutron stars, would have produced black holes copiously during their lifetimes. I'll add the comment, if indeed black holes were being produced, and you know, we didn't understand physics as we think we do. Such black holes would have been stopped by the material inside such dense stars, which is what Frank is saying. The stars are so dense that these black holes, if they're produced as the cosmic rays crashing, get trapped inside the star. Because again, quoting from the LHC report, the rapid accretion due to the large density of these bodies and to the strong gravitational interactions of these black holes would have led to the destruction of the white dwarfs and neutron stars on timescales that are much shorter than their observed lifetimes. The final stages of their destruction would have released explosively large amounts of energy that would have been highly visible. The observation of white dwarfs and neutron stars that would have been destroyed in this way tells us that cosmic rays do not produce such black holes, and hence neither will the LHC. So in fact, the answer to, you know, Frank's point was, why don't microscopic black holes created by cosmic rays swallow the neutron stars? Well, if microscopic black holes were created by cosmic rays, they would have swallowed the neutron stars, and since they haven't, they're not being produced, which is actually what our normal laws of physics tell us would be the case, but we shouldn't be producing those things.
So it was a very satisfying answer to an excellent question.
Okay.
Thank you very much indeed, Tim. And if you've got any questions that you'd like Tim to answer, please do write to us at the Jodcast via the webpage. And until next time, thank you very much.